Thank you, Jack. Everybody can hear me okay? I know there's a lot of people out there I don't know, but it's amazing to me of the people out there that I do know, how many of y'all were asleep a while ago? So hopefully some of you folks that I've worked with the Brank Association help me get some data. Maybe that'll liven you up a little because you'll see something up here that's pretty real or close to your heart anyway. So, you know, to get into a talk like I'm going to give today, talking about genetics of heifer fertility, typically, you know, when we talk about genetics of fertility or reproductive traits or whatever in beef cattle, you know, it's not a real great subject because heritability, at least our classic way of doing heritability, is pretty low. However, I'm going to talk about heifer fertility today and actually our heifer fertility traits. You know, you can argue that they're moderate to some almost highly heritable. So there's a good reason to study this. Another thing I'd like to just kind of throw out is that we went through talk today, you know, a lot of complexity stuff about genomics and so forth. And I thought Kurt Van Tassel did a really nice job of talking about we're going to feed all this stuff into this black box and get out of there a breeding value. Okay? And so my approach to this is a little different, or my role here is a little different than some others, because my training is actually in reproduction. I'm not a quantitative geneticist. I have to collaborate to get those skills done. So I have a real interest in genes and what the genes do. However, there's a next step beyond that. Okay? Because quantitative genetics folks are trying to get a breeding value, you know, an EPD, a plus one, minus one, whatever. But if we can identify the really, really important genes, then we're actually starting to talk about the next step beyond even high-density chips, and that is specifically gene-designed chips that would have on there the specific genes, but the allelic variants of the gene. Version A gives us something better than version B. Okay? And we can go maybe even beyond what Larry was talking about with, you know, things that are linked together on a chromosome where we actually know that exact gene. So I'm going to get into a little bit of that today. So I'm going to ask you, you know, to think forward quite a bit with emerging technology as we talk about that type of stuff. Also, just a little wake up, you know, to kind of tell everybody, I have a unique position for the next year. I'm the Gerald Thomas Chair at New Mexico State, and that's a real honor for me. Gerald Thomas was one of the first 10 people in the United States to get a PhD in rain science. And he was the Dean of Ag at, I'm not sure all of the background, but his final career position was Dean of Ag at Texas Tech University, and then he went on to be the President of New Mexico State University. So that's a neat thing that somebody like me, who went to high school here in Missouri, that now I work in a rain science department, and I thought about that on the way over today, that it was about an hour drive from my mother's over to here, and I saw more grass in that hour drive than if I drove all 8 hours across New Mexico. But it is kind of fun. The other thing I thought about as I got here today is that I can remember my first drive to Columbia to give talks. That would have been FFA speaking contest. And, you know, my advisor was really, really strict about, by gosh, you wear that tie and that blue jacket and get it all correct. And I noticed, though, that Seidenstrichers are actually our sponsor for this section, and that probably the only piece of attire that would have been allowed in our FFA chapter that didn't fit with that blue jacket and tie was if you had a green John Deere Seidenstricher cap on, that would probably be acceptable. Okay, so let's talk about genetics of heifer fertility. Let's see if I can run all this. So just a little background of an outline of what I'm going to talk about. This is actually kind of a continuation talk. I gave the first talk on this data at a NBCEC symposium in December. The title of my talk there was Molecular Advancements in Reproduction from Hare to Calves. So I know there's a few of you here that were here to hear that, and I'm going to build on that a little bit. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about some of this stuff that Larry was talking about, spots on chromosomes, where are these important chromosome regions, and then I'll get into the genes. And then I'm going to talk about, you know, what do we got to do to keep building this? Because this isn't easy, particularly when we work with fertility traits. If you think back in a little bit of the history of BIF, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, a lot of talk about the need to do whole herd reporting. Now we're not talking about that much anymore. You know, we moved into genomics there because we're doing that. But how long has it been since we started collecting fertility traits before we can actually start to spit out fertility trait breeding values? It takes a long time. And so actually the genomic research, the genetic research of fertility is the same thing. This is going to lag behind, you know, some of our carcass trait evaluations and so forth, because it's harder to get this data. So it's important to talk about building research populations and collaborations where we can get more of this data to go forward. Okay, usually people give this slide kind of at the end of who's all involved in what you're doing. Well, I'm not going to throw out any names because I'm collaborating with so many people right now, and there's so many of us having to work together to do this type of research that if I did throw out names, I would forget somebody. But I think it's just an important slide to understand that, gosh, it takes a lot of people to do genomic research, a lot of different backgrounds, and then it takes a lot of funding. And so I just want to mention that, you know, from universities to government groups, and NVCEC has been really instrumental in this project I'm going to talk about because it just seemed to be a venue that kept bringing us together to have discussion. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about this particular project, and then we'll go forward with that. So in 2005, NVCEC usually has what they call their December short course, and I'm sure quite a few in here have been to those. And each year the topic's a little different. But in 2005, that thing was called the Large Herd Manager Symposium. And I gave a talk with some just very, very minimal data on some genetic markers and fertility traits and so forth, because that's all we had at that time. And, you know, the main thing that came out of that was, guys, we got to pull our resources and get together and work on a bigger project to do more of this. And so we did. And so at that time, several university folks got together, myself, people from Iowa State, Bob Weber, University of Missouri, John Pollock was still at Cornell, and I was at ARS, and then, you know, another important group from Iowa State to do the bioinformatics for animal genome and so forth, got together and says, let's write a grant and start getting some larger funding together so we can study fertility. We were successful in doing that. Okay, so then we started being able to present some of that this year, December of 2009. So we started talking about that all the way in December of 2005. So all the way to December of 2009 before we presented it, and now here we are the summer of 2010. So, you know, 5 years went by in a heartbeat. You know, and so I think that would probably be what you would expect from a fertility trait project. It takes a long time to get the data. It takes a long time to get the money. But we're going to continue to work together, but that kind of gives you an outline of how long we've been working on this and, you know, how many people that have touched this project. So in this project, our long-term goal is to, you know, understand in real detail reproductive processes and then how you would be able to do genetic improvement if you had that knowledge. Okay? So when we first put this together, we said, well, this would be kind of our flow chart of activity. First, we'd go in and we'd find spots on chromosomes, important spots on chromosomes, which, in the scientific arena, we call that a quantitative trait loci or a QTL. But in here, I'm going to talk mostly about spots on chromosomes. And under those spots on chromosomes, we might try to figure out what the genes are, where the causal mutations are, and so forth. And then we'd take that out to other populations, and then that would be involved in technology transfer. Well, in the first 5 years of this, we've spent most of our time just kind of right up here. You know, and now we have infrastructure in our industry to actually do some of this other part, so maybe that's unrealistic for a group of scientists. One group of scientists get up and say they're going to do the whole big picture, but at that time, that was our thinking. But that's kind of where we started. And I'm going to talk a lot about this stuff today, but at the end of my talk, I'm going to talk about how important it is to continue to collect data and DNA samples on animals so that we can continue to do this type of research. So let me talk about a spot on a chromosome. This is chromosome 5, and there's an important spot right in here that's got lots of genes that we know what are. And of those genes, I'm going to talk about two of them. So this is kind of a unique thing that we got a spot on a chromosome that has a bunch of genes that we actually know what they are. A lot of these places, with these genomic techniques that we go to find a new spot, we detect a bunch of genes, and man, it's all new knowledge to us. But this is just some interesting studies that we've done. I wanted to talk about two genes on here just to give you some background information of challenges and realities about genetic marker information and so forth. But one of these genes is called PAPA, and I'm going to call it PAPA because it's actually papalysin. So here's an important hormone called insulin-like growth factor 1. That's secreted by the liver. And it goes from the liver over to the ovary and says, hey, make a follicle or make more progesterone or do something like that. And before IGF-1 can do that, it has to get out of the blood and attach those cells and tell it to do it. So IGF-1 is carried in the blood by a big binding protein. And what papalysin does is it dissociates it from that binding protein. Okay? And then after it binds its receptor and starts telling the cell, hey, do something, then these other little proteins like this right here, STAT2, are initiated in those cells and carry out the cellular function. Now that's a lot of in-depth physiology, but in a minute I'm going to show you how we've used this knowledge of these genes to actually associate with some fertility traits. And so what I'm getting at is if we work to build a better mousetrap, we know what these genes are, then we can, you know, start to use that in developing better breeding tools. So the way we did it with these genes is we had knowledge of these genes, and this is kind of a little bit different approach than what Larry did, but we evaluated these genes in different breeds. So we put together what you call a resequencing panel. So, and this was actually a pretty challenging thing to do. We went out and found, we got DNA from 8 Holsteins, 8 Brown Swiss, 8 Jerseys, and 6 of these beef breeds. And of these animals that we got in each of these breeds, they had no common ancestors in a 3-generation pedigree. So therefore we said, well, that's a pretty fair representation of the breed. Now, you think about that a minute. That may sound like just some real quick materials and methods to go through. But you can't imagine how much effort it took to find 8 Holsteins in the United States that don't have a common ancestor in a 3-generation pedigree. It's almost impossible. Almost impossible. So these animals do represent a very diverse pool of animals from each of those breeds. And so we would use tools. We resequenced these genes. We went in and found each animal's A, G, C's, and T's across there. And you know, use that to line up all that sequence and find out where the unique spots are. Okay? So then we said, okay, well, we have this kind of overall breed group. Now we need a test population. We found genetic markers in these genes within, you know, that are across these breeds. So now let's go test it. And so at that time, I had an opportunity to start working with a real unique data set. And it's actually a data set that belonged to the ARS group at Brooksville, Florida. And what it is, it's a dial allele. And what that means is that of each of these breeds, Angus, Brahman, and Romo Sinuano, they had a data set that had all of these crosses both ways. Okay, so sire of one on the dam of the other and the reciprocal of that. And I was real interested in that data set just because it was a big crossbred data set. And there's some real negatives to working with that kind of data for this kind of study. But I was real interested in that because I said, well, that's kind of like the U.S. beef industry. You know, it's lots of crossbred animals and so forth. Oops, wrong way. Also, you know, it is kind of, again, because it is an admixed population. It's got mixed ancestry. And the other thing about it was, is I thought as we looked at these genes, we would, and Larry was alluding to this kind of stuff, that a lot of the markers that we would discover in something like this are only going to really predict the ancestry, what breed it was from. So if we had that kind of information, we could really narrow it down to which markers actually were polymorphic among the breeds and might actually have a function. Okay? So here's a little data. Again, this is that list of genes, and I'm not going to make a big deal out of knowing that list. But what's interesting about this list is that out of all the markers that we worked with, we actually made a 75-marker panel that we were genotyping with. 59 of those markers, or actually it turned out to be 56 of them, basically only predicted the breed. So they were polymorphic only between breeds. And actually, out of those 75, there was only 3 that were pretty useful among all breeds. Okay, and Larry talked about that a bunch, you know, about it's very, very difficult to put together things that can work across all breeds, and therefore, you know, the initial genome breeding value projects and things that came out like within Holstein, well, that was the perfect setup. Okay, and us and beef cattle are going to have some real challenges to make that kind of thing work. Okay, so then we put that into, you know, some big hairy statistics and so forth, and our big thing we were looking for is, you know, could we, of these 3 genotypes, could we detect an effect, you know, with all of our statistics and so forth. And here's some initial data. Okay, and I'm not going to go through this slide with everything on it, but what I want you to see on this slide is that one of the reasons I got real interested in this data set initially was for this trait right here, age at first calving. And so what this data set did was, this original project was set up to be a carcass project, and so they did all these matings and they took the steers, put them in the feedlot and grew them and slaughtered them and collected all that data. And then the heifers, they really weren't sure what they were going to do with when they started. So what they did is they weaned the heifers off, put them out in the pasture, and put a bull with them, and left him until he got them bred. And so then when they calved, we got the true numeric value, age at first calving. Okay? And that's one another really challenging part about fertility data, is most of our fertility data is binary. So this heifer got bred in its first breeding season, yes or no. Well, as we move into doing statistics, binary trait analysis is a whole lot more difficult than these numeric trait analysis. So I was really excited about getting this data set. Unfortunately, though, I was really interested in this trait, age of first calving, and there was no significant about that trait in any of the markers that we were working with. However, though, as you get a fertility trait data set, one nice thing about it is it can grow. And that's one of the things we've done as we put together data sets, is that even though we started with heifer traits, they grow into first calf heifer traits, and then hopefully longevity traits, stayability, and those kinds of things. So our data set, this data set grew from initially my interest was age of first calving, but it's grown to things like calving interval, days to calving, pregnancy rate, you know, and that could be as a heifer or first calf heifer or whatever. And so what I wanted you to see here is that we're working with that PAPA gene, which makes IGF-1 dissociation from its binding protein in blood, so it can be used by the ovary. You know, we're getting significance of various markers within the PAPA gene. And that's very exciting. Okay? Very exciting. And what's even more exciting about that is there's going to be a paper come out in Journal of Dairy Science, and within the next few months, it's actually going to show that there are allelic variants in the PAPA gene. There's some forms of that gene that are more bioactive than others. And even though that's one very small example of the many kinds of examples we could come up with out of the 25,000 genes in the genome. But if we had more of that kind of information, you know, as we feed things into that black box, our information is better. So even though I'm not going to go over all this, you can see some effects coming across the genotypes. You know, preg rate, these animals here got more that were of these genotypes, you know, a much higher percent there. And it's, on this genotype down here, it's the inverse of that, but 90% versus 86. Those are pretty significant fertility differences. I know I'd rather have my herd at the 90% level right here than at the 86% level. So even though I'm not going to dig off into that deeper, you know, what I'm just trying to show you is that some of this will work. Okay? Another thing I just wanted to show you with the other gene that I threw out at you, and I know these are kind of just very specific examples, was, you know, this STAT gene that we were working with. So after this hormone bound its receptor and started telling these cells to do something, what I want to look at here is, let's look at this top panel up here. Okay, so over here on this trait, we got calving interval. Okay? And so calving interval in this case, when this Florida breeding group was, after they calved, their breeding season then was from March to June. Okay? So, depending on where they calved, okay, sometimes calving interval is, you know, pretty easy, 365 days. You calved March 1, you calved again March 1. But if an animal was born later or calved after June 1, they didn't get thrown into the system until the whole next year. So that data gets pretty exaggerated over here on this y-axis. Okay? But that's what's on the y-axis is calving interval. And then the genotypes that we're using them for this STAT gene is GHH is the homozygous, and this is not necessarily dominant, it's just homozygous one form. And this is homozygous the other form, and this is heterozygous. What I want you to see here is that we use some of those same techniques that Jerry used to sort the groups into breeds rather than just using the breed category. And if an animal primarily had the Brahman genotypes, okay, that's yellow. Okay. What's interesting is that the genes in Brahman, you know, told you information going in this direction. But if you were using those same genotypes and working with the Bos Taurus type cattle, in this case those were Angus and Romo Sinuanos, and Romo Sinuano is a Bos Taurus heat tolerant breed from Venezuela and Colombia, the information actually kind of goes in almost the opposite direction of what would be advantageous and disadvantageous. So again, the challenges of working with markers and genetic precision across different breeds, I just think that's a really good example of something that you can see that exact challenge. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit more about spots on chromosomes. And I'm going to start talking about Brangus cattle and some of the work that I've done with the Brangus Association. So Ken, you can wake up now. We're going to talk about Brangus. Ken, his group helped me get this data. John Spitzer, you've been asleep too. John and I serve on this breed improvement committee together, so you guys can wake up now. We'll talk about something that's real to you. So one of the things we wanted to do was, you know, could we actually detect these spots on chromosomes that regulated the heifer trait? And the first data we reported in December was actually the trait heifer pregnancy. Did she get pregnant her first year, yes or no, binary? But in that NBC workshop in December, we actually did a lot of interactive stuff with the breeders that were there, and they actually said that they thought the trait first service conception was more important to them than overall heifer pregnancy. So we said, well, hey, actually, in this data set that we have that we got from Camp Cooley, we actually had the data to analyze that trait. Okay? So that's why I'm going to show that today, and this is the first time we've shown that data, and we're going to have a graduate student that's going to present, you know, the real scientific end of this at the Animal Science Meeting this summer. Mark Cowan and I served on the Breed Improvement Committee together for many years with the Brangus Association, and so when I started talking about needing big data sets, I want to do this. Mark volunteered all the crew at Camp Cooley to help me do that, and I'm sure that Ken and everybody had to push the cattle through the chute to do extra bleeding. Really appreciated that, but I do appreciate the fact that they helped us get these data. Okay, so this is just a little background information on what this data set looks like. So we actually have a little over 800, it's 802 heifers, Brangus heifers, that we have both 50K genotypes and phenotypes on. Part of those, we had to supplement that a little bit with some New Mexico State heifer, Brangus heifers to get that to work. You know, typical suite of data on those heifers, as far as their growth traits that you would find on registered heifers, and those that are at means and standard deviations and so forth. You know, pregnancy rate in these Brangus heifers, now again, realize these animals are 3/8 Bos Indicus, is about 80-20. 80% will get pregnant as a yearling. 20% will not. And one of the reasons why I also started working with this data set was is that there was a lot of history, and Camp Cooley at that time had a tremendous resource of years back of heifer pregnancy data. And Matt Jones, who was their data manager, was really a very kind person and got me all this data together. And so I'm just showing you this stuff to show that, you know, there was a relationship there of working with between breeders and breed associations and so forth to get it. But Camp Cooley really had a nice resource in data. It had lots of sires. This data set has over 6,570 sires in it total. But so a really nice resource, you know, that it's in addition to our traditional ag experiment station resources. So this is kind of a slide like Larry was showing, but in a little different format. So what we have here is spots on chromosomes. So each of these white lines represents a chromosome. So chromosome 1 all the way to the autosomal chromosome 29 and then the sex chromosome XY. And so each of these colored spots is something that we detected, and we're using the same system that Larry was talking about. We're using the Bayes-C system, the GenCell system of Iowa State, to do these analysis. And then each of the colors here are, you know, represent something. So yellow on here is a birth weight QTL. And Larry was showing, if my counting was right on his slide from the work of Warren Snelling, chromosome 6 is a hot spot for lots of stuff. Okay? So there's a lot of stuff on chromosome 6. But what I'm going to focus on in here, you know, we all came to hear about fertility traits, is pregnant into the yearling are these red boxes with yellow lines around them. So a spot on chromosome 2 and 4. And then I want to show you this first cervice conception data. So I'm going to talk about some stuff on chromosome 8 because in December that's what breeders told me they wanted to hear about, was first cervice conception. Okay, so again, this is just taking that slide and just showing only the repro traits. You know, really a hot spot on chromosome 8. Okay? So now we have got several people in lab groups around the country. Jim Reese is going to talk next, and he works with a group that has made this website with all kinds of tools to start to take beyond what's a spot on a chromosome to where's a gene and what gene might it be. Okay? And that website is animalgenome.org. And within it is all kinds of tools to start to find out what the genes are. Okay? So one of the tools they have in there is called SNPplotZ. Okay? And it's if you took those white lines of chromosomes and laid them sideways. Okay? If we look at chromosome 8, you know, here's a significant marker, here's a significant marker, and here's one that's a hot spot, a really significant marker on chromosome 8. Okay? So the question for me as a physiologist is, what are the genes? So another tool on animalgenome.org is GBrowse. Okay? So here's that little region where those, you know, this little yellow spot represents those same markers, 1, 2, and 3 across here, and what genes lie under there. And actually it tells us, hey, there's 5 genes that lie under that spot right there. Say, that makes sense, right? We've got a hot spot on a chromosome. There should be some really important genes under there. Okay? So the next question is, oh, what are those genes? What do they do? Are they even related to fertility? So to get to that question, are these genes related to fertility? We're using some of these other new genomic techniques of sequencing to get that answer. So what we did was we took a non-pubertal heifer, and a prepubertal heifer and slaughtered them and took out a key reproductive tissue called the hypothalamus. That's a region of the brain that really controls the reproductive axis. You know, the reproductive axis is this thing where the brain talks to the pituitary and the pituitary talks to the ovary and the testes and so forth. So what we did is we took, this is a picture of one of the heifers that we slaughtered, is that we slaughtered one heifer when there was no way in the world she could be pubertal. And we started bleeding them twice a week, measuring blood progesterone, determine if this animal was actually having the hormone levels to be pubertal. So we slaughtered one way early in the spring. These were all spring-born heifers. And these are Brangus heifers that would be just like the heifers out of the Big Camp Cooley data set. And then we bled the other one all the way, you know, through the summer until she'd had normal estrous cycles, and then we slaughtered her. Okay? And then we took out this region of the brain, okay, so we could look at actually what genes might be under one of them spots on chromosome 8 that might be telling this heifer, hey, you're pubertal, now you have an opportunity to get bred for the trait of first service conception. Okay? So out of these five genes that I showed you out of G-browse, we have actually confirmed that all of those are actually expressed in the brain. Now that could be really exciting, or that could be a nightmare, because now I don't know which of these five genes is actually controlling this trait. Or maybe it is all five of them. I don't know. There's a lot of research here to do. And, you know, what do these genes actually do? You know what? I don't even know. And that's maybe the beauty of this subject is that I went through part of the reproductive sciences program here at Missouri, you know, and we spent a lot of time learning all these hormones and being able to write them on the board and all that. And now what we're finding out is that, gosh, we, you know, have years and years of knowledge, and we were finding out that we've only scratched the surface on how many other genes are actually out there. Actually, in the pubertal heifer, there was like 25,000 genes expressed, and in the prepubertal heifer, it was like 22,000. You know? And so we're narrowing it down here to five, and so we got a lot of work to do to figure out what in the world these five genes do to actually be involved in the trait first service conception. Okay? So that's our black box story. Trying to figure out if any of those genes actually, you know, have allelic variants and so forth. So the other part of this project I'm going to talk about is, you know, this effort of continuing to build resources, particularly to study fertility. Okay, because it is a long, drawn-out process. So we're doing two things. We're collecting samples from both breeders, experiment stations, and whatnot around the country to build up a bigger resource. So I have somewhere between 12 to 15,000 DNA samples now. Most of them are on blood cards that we can use to study fertility. About 60% of those samples come from classic ag experiment stations or USDA ARS facilities. About 25% of those samples are from seed stock and 15% are commercial. About 95% of those samples have some kind of Angus influence in them, red or black. 25% of them have some kind of continental influence, and then 40% of them have some type of Bos indicus or Brahmin influence in them. You know, and the idea of getting all that is if you're ever going to take this step of assessment and validation, you're going to need lots and lots of resources to do that. And so we're trying to position ourselves long-term to be able to continue this type of research. So this just gives you a little picture of, you know, where have we got all these samples from. On this actual map of the U.S., the letters A, B, C, and D, that's where the scientists that are on this team are from. And then all the numbers just represent different places that we've collected DNA samples and so forth. And we've done the best we can just to pool our resources. Like, this is where I live here in the Las Cruces, New Mexico, El Paso, Texas area. So, you know, I work closely with our experiment station resources, another big breeder and or producer in eastern New Mexico, Branch Ranch, and then another experiment station in Arizona. And so those are easy for me to coordinate. And so, like, Jim Reese and the group at Iowa State up here, you know, they can coordinate with easily with people in Iowa, plus their own experiment station resources. So we're just doing whatever we can put resources together. And now that the thing has grown, we have two international cooperators. A group in Sonora, Mexico is also collecting these types of samples for us. That's both a federal government group and a state experiment station group. And then we're also, there's a similar project to what we're doing going on in Australia with the BCRC program. So I'd like to take a few minutes and talk about that as well. So later today, there's actually going to be a talk by Gary Bennett of USDA MARC talking about an international consortium, a group that's working together doing genomics. And their initial effort was for feed efficiency, or RFI. And now we've kind of taken that same model and put that together, and there's a group of us working to do that for fertility traits. And my main collaborator in Australia is Rachel Hawken of CSIRO, and Warren Snelling is our other main guy here in the U.S. With USDA Mark. And let me talk a little bit about that. So they've done the same thing. They have used beef CRC resources and got cattle on four different experiment stations where they're collecting phenotypes and so forth. And so we've already started a lot of exchange. Rachel's been to my lab for a little time, and we both have PhD students now that are exchanging between the two universities. And then next summer, I'm going to spend most of my summer, the U.S. summer anyway, 6 weeks over there with the Brisbane group, you know, working on these two projects. And this is just some pictures of their cattle. So, as I showed, most of ours are Angus influenced. Their population is heavy Brahmin influenced, so part of their resources are actually straight Brahmin cattle. And then the others are what they call a tropical composite, which has a various bunch of breeds, but they are heavily Bos Indicus influenced as well. So, you know, just some real brief information from what Rachel's accomplished so far and just some things, you know. They're kind of doing the same thing with the fertility project. Their long-term goal is, can they commercialize markers and, you know, put something into that black box to help us do breed improvement. Same kind of issues, if you read this stuff you've got on here, challenges among breeds. Okay? You know, lots of Bos Indicus influence under there. And then that's how we got together, was we all understand that as we create things, you need to test it in other populations to see if it works and so forth. So this is just an example of something that one of the first set-down meetings that Rachel and I had together. Again, we're looking at spots on chromosomes. So this would be a chromosome, and across here would be, you know, megabases or regions across the chromosome. Blue is some results that Rachel had. So here was a hot spot on a chromosome for a fertility trait. And then the red dot is something that we found in the Brangus population that I'm working with. So we were really excited that, you know, our spots were agreeing, okay, at least for spots on chromosomes. Okay, so let me just throw out some conclusions. You know, to do this kind of research, it takes lots of collaborations at all levels to do this kind of thing. Our initial work of doing resequencing in candidate genes was very effective. We found some candidate genes, and now we even know that one of those genes has allelic variants. So that's a real step forward. And the scientific literature is almost void of that kind of information. And so I'm giving another talk at an animal science meeting this summer, and I'm kind of getting up on a soapbox to the scientists saying, we've got to create more of that kind of information. That's why the physiology group, the reprophysiology group, and the genomics group are kind of separated right now. It's just, we got to have that common information between us to make these things work for breed improvement. We're not having much trouble finding spots on chromosomes. That approach is definitely working. We probably need to refine those techniques, though, that we find more of those kind of spots on chromosomes. The multi-breed concept is really a challenge. I'm not going to stand here and say, hey, that's not going to work. I'm just saying it's a challenge, and we're all realizing it. And then again, my last comment was, you know, there is this gap between, you know, spitting out breeding values in spots on chromosomes and determining the functional alleles of the genes. There's a real need for the research to move and be able to do those kinds of things. So I guess my last conclusion is that we've already been at it 5 years, and boy, we got a lot of work to do yet. But that's where we stand, so I'll be more than happy to answer questions, entertain discussion, or anything like that. Yeah, Dave. Now, in our data that we had with the Brangus heifers that we did 50K on, that's a real extensive data set. Intensive data set. So we had, those were all synchronized, so we have that data. But a lot of our field data, it is what it is. It's field data. Some of it's experimentation data that would be synchronized and have very good records of that. And then some of it is field data where maybe the only record we have is pregnant, yes or no, and that was just written on the blood card. You know, I'm at the mercy of Ken Hughes and their group and the vet and the guy that comes out with his ultrasound machine, and whenever they made that first ultrasound record, his call. So, you know, it is what it is, Dave. I'm sure that if we could design projects, we might do it a little different. But in this case, you know, Camp Healy did us a huge favor and provided us this resource. Yes. Sure, as soon as we get our next $500,000, we'll run right out and do that. Yeah, I mean, that's the deal. We started with it here. You know, we've gone through one round of funding, so it's time to go after it again. So I don't think we'll re-genotype these heifers, but that is in our future. There actually is a project already going on like that with the Clay Center Group. And so they're actually using a pooling technique, so we don't have to do quite as many animals because it is very expensive. Yeah, Ken. I know some of these have. There was a set of Camp Cooley heifers, you know, that Gordon Carson's and them worked with. I'm going to have to ask Matt to actually tell me which of any of these records might overlap. There may be some, but I don't know if it's very many. Other questions? Yeah, so did everybody hear his question? As we find these genes here, are there chances that other genes suppress them? And that's correct. I mean, so as we look at doing breeding value using the whole genome, as I said, now we have knowledge that in the puberty heifer there was 25,000 genes expressed. So what we're moving to now is what we call a pathway analysis, where we draw pathways on the slide that has hundreds and hundreds of genes that we know kind of what they do in a pathway. And so, yeah, so if you have on one part of the pathway, an upregulation of this gene downstream in the pathway, it might downregulate something else. So that's what we're trying to do now, is to look at the whole big picture. So we've got two questions. Jared, and then... It is a gene that would contribute to the variation. I mean, we have no idea how many total might be in there. But in this case, we actually know one gene, and there are two isoforms of it in the protein. And they are different in their bioactivity. So if we got 25,000, we only got 24,999 more to find out about. Yeah, I agree with that. These SNPs here in this discovery population, at least for those 75, we did an analysis to identify the tag SNPs.
Okay.
So we had a whole lot more SNPs, even though we genotyped 75. Maybe we had 175 we started with, and then we went in and actually did, using HaploView, did a tag analysis to determine the tag. So the 75, I'm not going to say all of them are on our 75, but a majority of those SNPs on that panel were at least with the limited ability we had, identified as tag SNPs. But those SNPs aren't necessarily congruent with the bioactive isoforms. We still got to look at those as different things. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
I agree, and yeah, and that's my Ag Experimentation Project in New Mexico State is the Angus Brangus Brahman Project, and that is the beauty of it, is that we can identify an allele that came from Angus or Brahman and track its segregation like that. Other questions? Well, if we actually get numeric data for the trait age of puberty, it's pretty highly heritable. Actually, in humans, it's really highly heritable. And that's a numeric trait. But then when we convert it to a binary trait, yes or no, I'm pretty sure that and there's people in here who know a lot more about that than I would. If we convert it to a binary trait, heritability estimate's probably going to be pretty small just because that's a hard trait to work with. And actually, it kind of gets back to her question of, you know, working with, in Brancus, actually, that's a fairly good data set if you're working with yearling heifers because it's at least 80-20. If I were working with our Angus data, well, heck, there's no trouble at all with the Angus population I work with to get them pregnant as yearlings. You know, other things might, they have other challenges down the road, but that's another challenge with binary traits and particularly fertility traits is we're usually, we want them at least 90% pregnant. And so our data sets are heavily skewed of the success-failure recordings that we use for our statistics. All yearling heifers in that data set, yeah.
So would it be conceivable in your experience that I could test some heifer baby calves as a seed stock producer and identify those ones that would be pregnant on first service? Is puberty...
Boy, if I were that good, you and I'd be on our plane to Vegas right now. Well, I think that's where we'd like to go with DNA technology is that you could actually do some early culling based on some genotypes. But I think we need to be pretty realistic that when we talk about genotypes, you know, genotypes and then move into quantitative analysis where we start taking into account all the environmental variation. Yeah, but I mean I would say that that's always been a goal of people working with DNA is that hopefully we could do some early culling. Well, I would say this particular study reveals that this marker is associated with that. But that's one marker, and that's a very, very small piece of information.
Anything more for Milt here?